A mix of science and culture today on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, inviting you to settle in for some conversation. Coming up, a deep dive into the emerging mariculture industry, and a visit with Mark Brown, king of the blues in Fairbanks and one of the headliners at next month's Rock Auk Indigenous Music Festival. Now for our forecast for tonight, expect numerous rain showers with lows in the upper 30s, east winds from 10 to 20 miles per hour, gusts up to 40 miles per hour are also in the forecast. Tomorrow, rain showers, highs in the mid-40s with winds again coming out of the east, but by tomorrow night, it looks like we could see some drier weather, mostly cloudy skies until Monday night. Juno Afternoon, we'll be right back after National Native News. Listening to Juno Afternoon, thank you for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. Well, if our next guest had his way, the state of Alaska would give some serious attention to the aquaculture and mariculture industries. Joel Marcus believes that there is untapped potential to grow new markets. He's an associate professor of applied fisheries at the University of Alaska Southeast, based in Sitka, and he is tonight's presenter at the university's Egan Lecture Series, which you can watch online. But Joel is here now to give us a preview of his talk. Thank you for being here. And for starters, can you give us a quick explanation of the difference between aquaculture and mariculture?
Yeah. And so aquaculture, I would say, is a more broad term. It is really rearing any type of aquatic organism. Mariculture is a little bit more specific, and that's the cultivation of marine organisms for food. And so we're specifically focused on marine organisms, and these are not fish, ultimately. And so mariculture in Alaska typically focuses on shellfish and kelp, but there are some other species that are focused on as well. But generally speaking, in Alaska, when people talk about aquaculture, they're referring to the state's salmon enhancement program. And so essentially, before statehood, the state saw pretty drastic declines in our salmon returns. And so in the early 70s, we developed a salmon enhancement program where we take adult salmon, we spawn those fish, and then we basically help their offspring get through the most critical stages of their life so that they're not preyed upon by other species. And then we release them into the ocean, and hopefully in 2 to 5 years, they come back and we're able to capture those salmon and eat them as food. Just kind of, I guess, for a ballpark, the salmon enhancement program in the state of Alaska last year, on average, we released about 1.8 billion juvenile salmon into the North Pacific. Last year, which was actually a slightly lower return year, we saw about 34 million adult salmon return to the state, which had a rough economic value of about $70 million. And so that's, you know, money that is coming directly back into the state and captured through commercial fishermen and then sold in markets, you know, all over the country and all over the world.
In Alaska, you hear a lot about the importance that the fish be totally wild, that wildness is our brand. You hear a lot of opposition from fishermen to farm salmon, and then also some of these new developments, this gene splicing, where you can take a halibut and cross it with a salmon and get a fish that grows faster. They're called frankenfish. But do you think that aquaculture kind of gets a bad rap from all of these other things that have nothing to do with aquaculture?
I think that it's people not necessarily understanding the state's salmon enhancement program and how it works and the safeguards that are associated with those programs and the fact that none of those practices take place in Alaska. We don't farm fish in the state. I think for the most part, it's a lack of understanding of what actually happens with aquaculture in the state of Alaska.
So what do you think is the potential for aquaculture to enhance our fisheries? And to what extent, and would you put a dollar value on that?
One of the things we currently have our salmon enhancement program, but one of the potential growth sectors in Alaska is the mariculture industry. And so we've got what I would consider to be a burgeoning mariculture industry. And Mariculture is essentially cultivating organisms in the ocean for food that are not salmon, essentially, or not fin fish. And so these are, in Alaska, these are things like our shellfish, oysters, mussels, and gooey ducks, or a variety of different kelp species. And I think that there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in the state and the development of this mariculture industry.
Well, you have a lot of people farming kelp right now. And in fact, on Kodiak Island, there are even processors that are asking for permits to raise kelp. What's the status of that in Alaska?
Well, in Alaska currently, there's a variety of different seaweed or kelp species that are being reared currently. I think the average yield on those is in excess of about 100,000 pounds, which in the grand scheme of things probably isn't that much. But I think that there's a huge capacity for Alaska to increase the amount of kelp production that is taking place in Kodiak and in various other places around Southeast, be it South Central or Southeast. Seaweed, along with some of these other shellfish, does provide a huge opportunity for a lot of different Alaskans to get into this new mariculture industry.
Do people feel that there could be some environmental risks with this, that you grow too many different things, that you're taking away nutrients from other species?
I think one of the interesting things about a lot of the species that are cultivated for mariculture is that they're either collected from extremely local regions. And so the potential for them to do harm to those regions is extremely low. And a lot of the species that are cultivated actually have pretty large environmental benefits. Things like all the shellfish or bivalves that are cultivated, they're filtering the water. And so they're pulling things out of the water and actually filtering it. All the different kelps that are processed do the same thing. They're drawing up nutrients, they're sequestering carbon, things from CO2 emissions. And so there's a lot of actual environmental benefits to a lot of the species that are currently being reared in Alaska and the species that will be raised in the future.
So what are the barriers to mariculture getting a foothold right now?
I think there's a number of barriers. The interest is growing. There needs to be a market presence so that people that are actually raising these seafood products can actually sell them. There's got to be processing capacity. And so fishermen or individuals involved in the mariculture industry need to have a way to actually process the products into either food or even some of these other products. You know, we can turn things like some of the kelp species into supplements or into fertilizers. And so there's a number of different barriers out there, but there's a whole bunch of people in Alaska that are interested in overcoming a lot of these barriers. And the university and the state as a whole is looking at ways to try and solve some of these problems.
That's part of why you were invited to speak at the Egan Lecture, is to explain the role that the university hopes to play in mariculture.
Yeah. Mariculture is kind of an interesting example when you look at the university, because all three major campuses, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the University of Alaska Anchorage, and the University of Alaska Southeast, have a role to play in the mariculture industry, whether it's research. The College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences has a very large graduate program where they do top-notch research on things, whether it's training through Alaska Sea Grant, teaching some of the different current fishermen or folks involved in mariculture new techniques or skills, or whether it's workforce development through the University of Alaska Southeast and folks in our fisheries program teaching students the skills necessary to enter into this new emerging industry.
So what kind of skills would they need?
Well, in mariculture, it's a variety of different skills. A little bit of a science background. They need to understand oceanography and how water chemistry and ocean conditions change. They need to do simple things like drive boats and tie knots. And so our program has a curriculum that kind of focuses on broadly on a number of those different aspects, at the same time teaching students how to actually spawn and grow and rear some of these different seafood products successfully.
Wow. Do you think that this is a new frontier for Alaska mariculture?
I think it is. I think when you look at other portions of the world, they have invested pretty heavily in mariculture. And I think given our vast coastline and our pristine waters, I think that we've got an opportunity to really do something that not only creates clean, delicious food, but also helps the environment at the same time. And so I think there's a lot of the people that see value in that. And I think that there's an economic value to be had there as well.
Well, one of the things, though, you hear from people that are in the mariculture business, growing kelp, and also oyster farms and things like that, is that there is no capacity to process things locally, that there's sending things out. And it's kind of the same dynamic that Alaska experiences with its other fisheries, that the value is added to the product outside of Alaska. So there aren't the jobs. So how do you think that the universities could help that, to have more processing capacity?
Well, I think the university has a role to play in some of the research that goes into the types of seafood products that we create and the processing techniques that we use in processing these different products. But then the hope is that as some of those new skills and techniques are developed, that the industry then adopts those and works with the fishermen and the folks that are involved in the actual industry to help ramp up that capacity so that we can solve one of those many challenges to the industry.
Right. What will it take to avoid the same dynamic that we have seen with the other fisheries, where basically we're just providing the product, the raw product, and it goes out of state to have its value added?
I think it takes creative ideas. You know, you look at some of the products that are being produced currently around the state from some of the mariculture organisms that are collected. There are people doing really creative things and creating unique products that are catching people's eyes, and they're making money doing it. And so I think a continued focus on some of those things, whether it's through seafood processing capacity, but even things like developing business models to help people market some of these products, I think all of those things are going to be integral parts in the development of this industry.
So what do you see for Southeast Alaska? Do you think there's kind of an economy of scale in Southeast Alaska geographically that would lend itself very well to mariculture?
Personally, living in Southeast Alaska, I may be a little bit biased, but I do. I think that a lot of our communities, despite being separate, are fairly well connected. We all kind of share similar environments and similar habitats. And frankly, we've got some conditions that really lend themselves to developing some of these mariculture products. We've got a little bit warmer water than folks do further up north. We get a little bit more sunlight than they do. And so there's a couple of things just kind of right off the bat that I think really set Southeast up in a good place for being a location where mariculture could really take off.
Plus, you would have people that would be able to share their expertise when they work within one region.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think our communities are pretty well connected already. And one thing that works well in this location, there's a good chance it may work fairly well in another location. And so they people can share those ideas and share some of those techniques for sure.
If people come away from your Egan lecture with one thing, one message, what would that be?
Oh, one message. I think it would be kind of an awareness of this emerging industry and the opportunity that exists there. And then just hopefully as people kind of work through their day-to-day lives, that they're a little bit more aware of kind of the potential that Alaska has to develop this industry into something that could mean good, exciting jobs for people, could mean delicious seafood products that are healthy and wholesome and that are helping to be environmentally friendly and maybe even tackle some of the challenges that we're facing with the climate also.
Well, mariculture requires some investment, but do you think that there is less investment there than, say, in fishing boats that go out in the ocean?
I guess it depends on what the products you are that you're trying to cultivate. You know, I'm sure there are some farmers out there that would say that it's a lot more expensive than just having a boat and going fishing, but I imagine it would be on par, you know. And I think some of the places where folks may leverage resources would be folks that are currently involved in commercial fishing operations that may have a boat that already has hydraulics, that has already a sense of the ocean and the sea and is comfortable driving and moving around and operating equipment. Those might be people that would get into this industry and benefit from it in the off season when they're not fishing for some of the other species that they typically target.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joel Marcus, for giving us some insights into what could be the industry of tomorrow. So thanks very much for being here with us.
Great. Thanks, Rhonda. It was a pleasure.
Joel Marcus will take your questions at tonight's presentation, which will be live streamed via Zoom at 7. It is free, but you do have to sign up, and you can do that online. Just go to uas.alaska.edu/EganLecture/.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon, and you're listening to a man known in Fairbanks as the King of Blues, Mark Brown, one of the headliners at next month's Rock Ock Indigenous Music Festival. He has recorded more than a dozen albums, and crowds pack into whatever venue he and his band, Mark Brown and the Blues Crew, play at. He is always on the go, but he did carve out some time to visit with us. Mark, I can imagine that even though you've done a lot of things, that you're probably pretty excited to be a part of Rock Ock.
I'm very excited. I can't wait to play there. I've never played in Juneau before, and I've been wanting to play there for 20 years.
And I understand that you're bringing your blues crew with you.
Yes, we have Carlos Ugarte on bass. He's a guy from Bolivia that was actually famous there, but he moved to Fairbanks and he joined up with my band. And I have David Peck on drums. He's from Chico, California. And our very first show together was at the NAMMYs when I won the NAMMY for the best blues. I think that was like 2011. So we've been playing together for 10 years.
So you won in 2011 for the best blues recording, and also you were nominated for Group of the Year. What is it about the chemistry of your band?
I think we do way more shows than any other band. So we've developed this really intense chemistry. We know what the other is going to play before he even plays it. And we kind of just interact off each other. We're very close on and off the stage. So we have a really nice chemistry.
Your band has won so many battles of the bands in Fairbanks. They're just an all-around popular group. It seems like anytime I visited Fairbanks, I'll see a poster advertising your group playing at some venue. How did that happen?
I don't know. I just was persistent when I was a young guy and lucked out and was able to play with some really talented musicians. And I just became a sponge and picked up every little piece of information that I could from anyone. I have no ego, and I'll learn from anybody. Even if they only have one thing that they can teach me, then I would gladly learn it.
Well, you grew up in Huslia, which is a tiny community on the Koyukuk River. And of course, it's one of those communities, one of several, where that old time fiddle music is still alive. Was that an influence for you?
It was a very big influence. My great grandfather was arguably one of the best fiddlers ever. His name was Sammy Sam. And I remember listening to him when I was a little kid, and you could tell that he was like on a totally different level than the other fiddlers. He was amazing. And then his son, my grandfather, was the one that got me started. His name was Tony Sam, and he was also a very talented fiddler and guitar player.
So was there a push to get you to pick up the fiddle?
Yeah, there was. My grandfather actually gave me my great-grandfather's fiddle, and I still have it. It's like a 1912 fiddle. It's a really old antique. I just don't feel like comfortable enough and adept enough to play in front of people. So maybe one of these days I'll surprise someone or, you know, an audience and play it. I'm just not as good as I am on the guitar.
What was it about the guitar that made you prefer it over the fiddle? Because I can't think of a more amazing instrument to play than the fiddle. Everybody loves a fiddle player.
I think a big part of it was I idolized Herbie Vent, and he was also from Huslia, and he was the main guy that was traveling around to play at all the events. I just wanted to, you know, kind of be like him, and he was a guitar player and the leader of the band, and I was actually a drummer when I first started out. When I picked up the guitar, I knew that that's what I was meant to do. And I've been playing it ever since.
Do you think that that could have something to do with your singing voice? Because you have an amazing singing voice, and perhaps playing guitar was a way that you could use both of those talents at the same time. I don't know.
I developed my voice. I never was like born with a voice. I hear all these young people that are coming up that are just naturally gifted singers. And my voice just took years and years of practice. Like if you hear my first three albums, they're like horrible. Then I just slowly got better and better. And by the fifth or sixth album, I was starting to sing pretty well.
A lot of times when I hear the old-time Athabascan fiddling, I feel like I'm going back a century or more, that somehow these Athabascan fiddlers have captured that time and they've kept it in their music.
That's a really good portrayal, because that's kind of what I feel too. Like whenever I walk into the hall and a fiddle group is playing, I like always have these memories pop up, like 1978, listening to my great grandfather or something. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I always feel transported in time when I hear those. So how did you soak all of that up? I mean, how did it come to influence your sound?
I really wanted my grandfather to teach me when I was little. And he told me, well, the only way I'm going to teach you is you have to learn gospel music first.
Interesting. So
that's what I started out on. And when I was like 11, he switched me over to country music when I was around 12. Then I started playing rhythm guitar in his group. I think around when I was around 15, they moved me to the bass guitar.
Well, there is an advantage to playing all the parts, is you know how they all fit together when you're leading the band.
Yep, exactly.
How have you seen that help you?
I don't know. Just practice makes perfect. And I've been doing this for so many years that it's just a part of me now. I don't even think of anything. I just pick up the instrument and play, and I don't know.
So how old is the Blues Cruise band?
I think we were formed in 92. We were waiting for my first album to come out, and it was actually just titled Mark Brown, because that was before the Blues Crew. I was playing music with this old black guy, Derek Jackson. We were having like engine troubles driving to Anchorage, and he said, man, we sure are a blues crew. And I was like, man, that's it, that's what we're going to be called. And he started laughing. He's like, oh man, no, we can come up with something better than that. But yeah, so we showed up at the gig, and a mechanic was actually working on our vehicle in the parking lot while we were playing music, and somebody said Mark Brown and the Blues Crew, and it just stuck. That was 93.
So do you think that you have an identity in Fairbanks as a native band or just a blues band?
A lot of people even classify us as a rock band because there's not a whole big audience for blues anymore. We don't really get to play a lot of it, even though that's what we're best at. We're mostly a dance band and we have to play a lot of rock music and a lot of my originals. Some shows we don't play blues the whole night. It's just a totally different atmosphere. Like when I'm in Chicago, I get to step out and play what I'm best at. And that's just once in a great, great while.
So what are you best at?
Definitely the blues. I've held my own against some of the best blues guitar players in Chicago. I wish I could play blues every weekend, but it just doesn't happen. People want to dance. It's mostly classic rock.
Classic rock. Well, your 10th album, Indian Rock and Roll, that's the one that won the Native American Music Award for Best Blues Album. The title song is kind of your calling card. It's what people know you for. Tell us how you wrote that song. What's the backstory on that song?
I didn't even write that. I made it famous, but I did not write it, though. My friend Louis Damosky actually wrote it. He's a guy from Galena, like the neighboring town from Huslia. I never imagined it being as big and well-known as it is. I was actually just playing it for an extra song on the album. We put it out in 2002, but we just learned it like a week before that. So that recording isn't as good. So then in 2010, we re-recorded it and it became the title track of the album.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to your album.
Okay. Funny thing is that album that won us that award was actually a song called The Way You Walk. That's the one that I entered. And everybody thinks Indian Rock and Roll won, but that was just the title of the album. The one that entered the NAMMYs was called Way You Walk, and it was like a blues shuffle.
All right, well, let's give a listen to that.
Girl, I miss, it's true. Need your loving, I hope you need me too. Love you, baby, I ain't never gonna let you go. Love you, baby, I ain't never gonna let you go. Need your loving, you might like to know. Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing that I turned up was a theme song for Heartbeat Alaska. And many people in Alaska have enjoyed seeing Jeannie Green's program about rural Alaska for years. How did that come about?
So we were playing on statewide television before, and I was kind of joking around. I said, hey, I'm going to write you a song for your TV show. And she said, yes, do it. I'll put it on the show. So then the next time we were driving back to Anchorage a couple months later to do like a fundraiser, my bass player, Derek, he was like, hey, did you ever finish that song we were supposed to write? Because aren't we supposed to play that tonight? And I'm like, what? And we pulled off the side of the road and I picked up my guitar and I just wrote that song right on the side of the highway.
Pretty good song for an impromptu song, but sometimes that is how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just comes out of you.
It's Heartbeat Alaska. It's Heartbeat Alaska.
Another song I'd like to ask you about is Some Kind of Love.
That's a pretty cool song. It has a really tricky chord progression because I wrote it on an acoustic guitar, which was tuned down, and that my voice became accustomed to singing at that lower key. So that when you pick up the electric guitar, which is tuned to standard tuning, you have to play all these weird chords that, I mean, nobody writes in those weird chords, but that's what my voice was used to. So we kind of adapted it to that. And it's got a really nice sax solo in there by Jason Slats. It's a pretty cool song.
Well, let's play a little of it. And what should we be listening for in this song? What are you proud of?
It's got some pretty good lyrics in there. I remember when I showed it to my band, they were like, man, this sounds like it belongs in a movie. It's got some pretty good lyrics.
All right, let's give it a listen.
Precious love, the kind of people only dream of, the kind of love you see on TV, the kind of love just for you and me. I ain't got a lot, I got a big heart. Sunshine, baby, it belongs. some kind of love.
Just in starting to wrap things up, I'd like to ask you about the upcoming Rock Ock Festival. You have achieved a lot of local fame. If I ask people what was the most popular band in Fairbanks, your name might likely roll off the tongue. And I think for a lot of Native American musicians, it's been a more of a struggle. So what does this festival mean to you?
It's hard to explain that without sounding like I'm bragging, but I can't wait to play in front of those musicians, because that's where we play our best. When there's great musicians in the audience, we always like step up a whole nother level, and we do stuff that we don't realize we're even capable of playing it. It's pretty cool. We did a couple of shows in Tacoma a few months ago. Like half of the audience were all these great musicians, like all the best guitar players in Tacoma and Seattle area. And we put on a couple of the most amazing shows that we've ever done. And we just want to play our best to let them know that we're there.
Well, I think that happens at a lot of music festivals. When you get a good group of musicians together, they come to a higher level because just being together brings that out of them. Is that what you expect to happen at this festival?
Yeah, I'm expecting some really, really good music to be played, not by just our group, but by the other groups. It's going to be really amazing.
One of the things that the organizers have said about this festival is they don't believe that there has ever been in the United States an indigenous music festival, and certainly not one like Rock Ock, organized by natives, for natives. Have you ever played at anything like Rock Ock?
Not as far as rock music goes, but I mean, every year they have the Fiddler's Festival. It's all natives, but not at this level and not with this like type of talent. Like they have all these great groups coming. I don't think anything has ever been done like this before. Maybe in Albuquerque or somewhere, you know, but definitely not in Alaska.
So what does this mean to you?
People have been talking about this, doing something like this for years. To have someone actually step up and do it is a totally different thing. It's going to be really awesome. I'm really looking forward to it.
And so what kind of a concert are you preparing?
I'm going to pull out all the stops and we're going to play the best music we've ever played. And I feel sorry for whoever has to come on a stage after us. That's it. That sums it up.
So
they're gonna put on a virtual concert after us, because we're prepared. We've been doing this for a long time. We do 120 shows a year. We're really looking forward to it.
All right. Well, you don't lack confidence. And that might be the key to your success.
Yeah, I've been playing guitar for like 46 years, I guess. So I kind of know how to do it a little bit.
I guess so. So we're going to say goodbye and go out on your song, Keep On Smiling. But before we go, tell us a little bit about that song.
Okay, so this song, my late uncle wrote the chords and a verse. It had a different chorus. He wasn't like adept as I am at writing lyrics, so he wanted me to add a couple of verses, and then I ended up rewriting the chorus. And my late friend Derek Jackson actually wrote the bridge, but he wouldn't let us put his name on the credits. He didn't want to take credit for his part. He actually wrote the bridge where the solo comes in, and it's one of my most complete songs, and a lot of it is from those guys. You know, they're both gone, Peter Holtschies and Derek Jackson, but it's one of our most well-known songs, I guess.
Well, it's a good sentiment to keep on smiling. And I'm sure that a lot of people are going to be smiling as they watch Rock Auk.
I can't wait. It's going to be so much fun.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mark Brown, for joining us. And he will be here for Rock Auk with his blues crew. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure.
Yes, it's you who I love. It's true, you are all I'm thinking of. When you're down, I'm not around. Don't be sad, I'll be back in town. When you miss me, feel like crying. When you miss me, feel like dying. Keep on smiling.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
ways to listen to KTOO's sister stations, KRNN and KXLL. You can find KRNN on 102.7 like you always have, but if you're listening from downtown Juneau and Douglas, you can now tune in to 103.1 FM. Also, KXLL can be heard on two different frequencies, 100.7 FM, and in downtown Juneau and Douglas, you can tune in to 101.7 FM. Well, that will do it for Juneau Afternoon, broadcast live on KTOO 104.3 FM, online at ktoo.org, and repeated at 4 on KRNN 102.7 FM. Juneau Afternoon is a production of the KTOO Arts and Culture team, which includes Shelley Delaney, KXLL's Chandra Boom, and leader of our team, Cheryl Snyder. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host for today. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. And until next time, thank you for joining the conversation. From all of us at KTOO, Ganakshish. Have a great weekend. Thank you.